Hello, everyone. It is March 27, 2024. Welcome back to Metropolis, hosted by myself, Calden Datsimpa. Today's guest, Lital Khaykin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. I had a nice lunch today. Since you asked, I had a chicken sandwich. Lital, we have you on today. We have a you wrote this interesting article in Pivot. If we could go to the first slide, we have a little picture of it here. So here we have: de plus en plus dur d'accéder aux services sociaux et de santé dans Hochelag Maisonneuve. So here you have this article in Pivot where you talk about the increasing difficulty of accessing social and health services in Hochelag Maisonneuve. Could you, I guess to start off this conversation, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
To actually get into it, could you give a little background on this, on the neighborhood, on the impetus for this article? And
Yeah, so the article is, it's kind of situated within a bigger picture of the privatization of the Quebec's health sector and the kind of the erosion of public health and social services. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, obviously having an effect on different neighborhoods, Hochelag and Maisonneuve being one of them. And yeah, as we've seen, like over the fall, over the winter, you know, strikes in the public health and social services network show that, you know, working conditions are deteriorating. This is obviously having an impact on the actual services being provided in centers that do exist, in institutions that exist. And it's also incentivizing like poor working conditions, low wages, or wages that aren't keeping up with inflation, are incentivizing workers in the sector to go toward the private sector. And this is basically creating gaps that are, which is what this article kind of talks about, community organizations are sort of filling the gaps. This should not be happening. Mm-hmm. The services should be provided by the public health and social services network, but here we are. So just to kind of illustrate some of the gaps that that are present, it's the loss of and inability to retain like family doctors, mm-hmm. Youth psychologists, therapists, counselors, nurses, and often also administrative staff. And the administrative angle is where a lot of the community organizations are kind of stepping in formally and informally.
It's really across the board then, across these, like a lot of different sectors of health and social services that are sort of deteriorating then.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And obviously community service organizations can't step in and do everything. Like they're sort of... they're patching in where it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically because the public health and social services network is unable to serve the community, the services are kind of being, the gaps are being patched somewhat haphazardly. So and just to also kind of give a little bit more information, a report by La Table de Quartier Hochelag et Maisonneuve. I'm just going to refer to them as La Table.
Yes.
So La Table and Le Comité des Usagers de CSSS Lucille Teasdale. Mm-hmm. They describe that Hochelaga Maisonneuve is marked by inequalities. Mm-hmm. In the public health and social services sector, there's been a lot of reporting, you know, in mainstream media to some degree, basically restating the same thing, that it's, it's marked by inequalities and... It's been referred to as a little bit of a medical desert. It's this is especially pronounced with the lack of family doctors. According to their report, just over 42% of men who are covered in the survey don't have a family doctor, and just over 23% of women who were in the report don't have a family doctor. To access hospitals, people in Hochelag et Maisonneuve have to go to Hôpital Maisonneuve Rosemont, mm-hmm. or Hôpital Notre-Dame. Both of these are quite far. You do have to rely on public transit or, you know, get a cab or Uber.
Sure. Which is so costly.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, so they're in theory accessible, but in practicality, like, if you can't afford public transit, it makes it very difficult, and the distance is quite significant.
That's a lengthy walk, I believe, to both of those hospitals.
Yeah. I'll talk about that a little bit later as well, because people do have to basically walk very long distances or leave the neighborhood entirely to access services. But some other things are long wait times. You know, this is common knowledge, but there are long wait times for youth psychosocial counseling. This was brought up in the interviews for the article. That youth have to wait around 6 months to access services, or they have to go to Rosemont. Mm-hmm. Also, again, it's quite far, but one aspect that was mentioned was just, again, sort of an emotional toll to, like, you have to go out of your home neighborhood in an already vulnerable state and get services somewhere that's unfamiliar, and, you know, that can be quite stressful. And
even that 6 month wait is that can be very I think very long for someone in that kind of state.
Absolutely. This is youth. For adults, it's also like somewhere between 1 to 2 years.
Oh wow, yeah.
So it's quite dire. Yeah. And this was public mental health services in Hochschlagemison of waiting time of 1 to 2 years.
Yeah, wow.
I think Emmanuel Cri from the Organisation Populaire des Droits Sociaux had mentioned something like 800 to 900 people on the waiting list approximately. So it's that should give you an idea.
Wow,
of scale.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a very long time.
Yeah, even just for two hospitals, that's like, even if it was like they had a third hospital there, that's quite the quite the patient list for them.
Yeah, yeah. This is, I believe he referred to the CLSC, so it's more like the community.
Oh, right.
But yeah, same.
Yeah, I mean, especially, I guess, with the, that goes to show the kind of, like, this extra, I guess, the extra mental load, emotional load of kind of, like, living these times. Our infrastructure, our kind of health infrastructure is clearly not really able to deal with that extra burden.
Yeah. And definitely, I mean, we'll talk about this in a second as well, but the infrastructure, like the actual, sort of built environment and the changing actual environment is also creating additional stresses.
Everything's cracking.
Yeah. And what this is basically showing is that these are some of the gaps that already exist and that are being exacerbated. So this is where community organizations are kind of stepping in.
Mm.
And this is where this article kind of comes in to talk about that. And the organizations sort of talk about where they stepped in or what their observations are. Basically where the community organizations are patching gaps, some of that work is administrative. So that's booking appointments, navigating online platforms to set rendezvous, filling out forms for social assistance applications.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, they're also providing services. So having like a nurse on site.
Sure.
Part
of that work is helping community members sort of navigate the kind of navigate these health systems.
Yeah. Right. And in the case of having a nurse on site, mm-hmm. that's at the Centre de Marie Debout. I'll introduce them in a bit, but they do have a nurse on site for 1 day a month for sexual health.
Mm.
And it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like it's both good in terms of having a service for the community, but it's also it's 1 day a month.
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
has its limits.
It has its limits. It's sexual health. It can be difficult to address emergencies, especially if you don't want to go to more like formal medical health.
Or, of course.
Yeah, kind of expose yourself to the Quebec's public health system.
It sounds like there's this kind of like deteriorating public health system. These community groups are trying their best to sort of fill the gaps, but clearly mm-hmm. the demand is much greater than their capacity to fill those
absolutely.
Gaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's, we see that the demand is much, much greater. Kind of going into one of the later points is the sort of solutionism around, private privatization supposedly taking the burden off of the, right, the public health system.
It's a classic formula. Yes. Let the public health system deteriorate. Mm-hmm. Point at how it's deteriorating, and then let the private sector kind of take more and more of a hold of something that should not be for profit.
Exactly. Yeah. Which there's a parallel to that in terms of the neighborhood itself, of being allowed to kind of deteriorate and be sort of.
Well, it's funny that you say deteriorate, because there are some players which would say the neighborhood is improving.
Yes, there are.
Yeah. So I'm speaking generally to the kind of I guess the marketing of real estate, the people who kind of benefit off of gentrification. If you could give me a little portrait of gentrification in the neighborhood, because I think most of our listeners and watchers might not be familiar with the neighborhood. It's sort of out east, but every now and then I see comments in some little Montreal Facebook groups I'm in. Some little Montreal Facebook groups I'm in where they talk about how they go to the neighborhood now, and they talk about, oh, it's so much cleaner, it's so much kind of nicer now. So could you give me a little portrait of the neighborhood and kind of what the gentrification has been like?
Yeah. So Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, it's quite a large neighborhood. It's also part of the Mercier Hochelaga-Maisonneuve borough. Mm-hmm. From just to kind of give a sort of geographical picture. From the west to the east, it kind of goes from the Canadian Pacific Rail on the west. And if you can imagine, there's the bridge that's after Frontenac, and you go on to Rue Ontario Est. And, it sort of starts around Moreau.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes all the way east to about the CN tracks around Vio. There are a lot of new condo buildings around that section.
I think we have a photo of one of those condo buildings.
Yes.
Right there. There we go. Yeah.
Well, yes, actually this one, it's a few blocks down from Vio, so it's actually quite illustrative of the redevelopment that's happening in that block. But so that's kind of west to east, and then south to north. It kind of spans from the Fleuve Saint-Laurent, Notre Dame, kind of goes all the way along the length of the neighborhood up to Rue Rachel-Sherbrooke.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite a large neighborhood, so there's income diversity within the neighborhood, but it is the contrast and the disparity is becoming more evident within the neighborhood,
right,
with the redevelopment. Whereas before, it used to be a little bit more of Hochelaga-Maisonneuve in contrast with the rest of Montreal. So the gentrification process has been sort of underway for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the early 2000s. And it's kind of followed the typical template of new condo developments, rent evictions, and a sort of a rebranding exercise. The neighborhood, it has a higher concentration of social housing,
mm-hmm,
in Montreal, and a lot of rental, lower income rental housing has been left to deteriorate and kind of fall into disrepair by slumlords. This is a picture, this is a photo of a building with some 2.5 smaller apartments. The building is in absolute disrepair. So this is, it's located kind of on the far end of Sainte-Catherine Est. The experience of actually going down Sainte-Catherine is, the contrast becomes very apparent. As you kind of pass Pineuf, which is the big throughway that goes to the north.
Right. That's right next to the Olympic Stadium.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So as you go further east from there, the contrast just becomes more pronounced. So there used to be a lot of mom and pop shops. So some dépanneurs, old clothing stores, not really trendy, mm-hmm, but something to wear.
Of course.
And a lot of these shops are now standing vacant, and the sense of when you go down the street, you're really surrounded, you're struck by the sense of absence, of these, it's mixed commercial real estate and apartments, but you really have the sense of abandonment in the neighborhood. And a lot of these, you know, this is just one example, but a lot of buildings are very visibly, you know, they're crumbling.
Derelict.
Derelict. And if you peer through, like, the window, like, the front door here, I mean, there's...
Of this building.
Yeah, you can see, like, there's, you know, like, rubble everywhere. There's, sure. There was, like, a medical clinic also just a block down that has long since shuttered. So, yeah, there's this real sense of... the contrast is grotesque. Mm-hmm. When you look across the street from this building, there's this new development by a company, LIFA, and they're these glitzy, like, sleek new condos, you know, 5.5, so quite large. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it's grotesque, and it's just so, it's kind of shocking. You know, if you go down the street every day, mm-hmm. it becomes part of your...
Of course. You know, but if you just take the second to, like, take it in, is like quite a disparity, I guess, between this old Oschlager Maisonneuve, which is much more like working class, poorer, and this new one that's sort of like cropping up within it.
Yes. Yeah. And again, it's just becoming like more evident that disparity within the actual neighborhood. The rebranding of the neighborhood is kind of its own discussion.
I think our next slide is sort of touches on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is, it's just an example that kind of captures the spirit of the rebranding of Oschlager Maisonneuve.
Yeah. So what is this website we're looking at? So for we do have some listeners. So right now we're looking at a screenshot from a website called HP and Associé. They are it looks like a real estate developers. Yeah. And we have a section here that says cheap rents. And I guess they're sort of selling the... Oh, yeah, no, I mean, I'll let you read it. I'll let you talk more about this, but...
Yeah, it pretty much, it captures the spirit of it entirely. But yeah, even today, Oschlager bears the imprint of its working class past and its social precariousness. Underpaid workers, precarious artists, prostitution, drug addicts, ellipses... The cliches attached to this underprivileged neighborhood speak volumes about the weight of its past. The reality is more nuanced. The social mix is more present than it seems. Oschlager attracts today more young professionals and families with young children who see the potential of certain residences after a few strokes of the brush and other renovations.
After a few strokes of the brush, this is like, this is haunting.
Yeah.
This is like inside the minds of the people who are kind of fueling the gentrification. We get to see a little bit about how they view the neighborhood and how they market it specifically, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. And
I think it's interesting just to hear how they're talking about the past, the social weight, like the weight of the past.
Yeah. Because the weight of the past, because it is kind of, it is a erasure, an active erasure sort of in progress, both in terms of like the physical reality, but also the association, the neighborhood, the history of it. Like this is, you know, it's gone now. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's...
Don't worry about that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah. This is good for your kids now.
Yes.
Yeah. That's sort of their line of argument.
Yeah. And that's basically, the neighborhood does have, this association, like it's historically working class. Mm-hmm. It is also primarily, historically primarily Francophone, mm-hmm. With high levels of poverty, and it has been associated with, the sex work industry. One kind of example of erasure has been, so before COVID, there was a block that was known, in Montreal, known in Oschlager Maisonneuve for the sex work industry. Mm-hmm. It was frequented by workers. It was Moreau and Adam. This is a few years ago now, but since COVID, there are like police cars and police vans that are routinely parked just around the corner by the CP, mm-hmm. The Canadian Pacific tracks, and just up the block, like that portion of the street around Rue Ontario and Moreau has been redeveloped. There's a new condo building that was completed about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and there's like new boutiques that have kind of cropped up in some of the industrial buildings, And the Loft Moreau was infamously rent evicted in 2013 when affordable artist studios, I mean, the building was allowed to fall into disrepair and artists were rent evicted, and then the building was, it was basically redeveloped into new artist studios, but they were more
much more expensive. Yeah, classic.
Yeah. So, all that to say that, this association with underpaid workers, precarious artists, prostitution, and drug addicts being, you know, a thing of the past. Mm. The people, you know, people in, you know, in these industries, people with, you know, this life, have always been there. They are still there, but they've just been.
They're considered sort of a thing of the past. They're trying to be removed from whatever kind of public eye.
From the public eye.
Make things much more sterile, clinical, easier to sell to whoever's buying these condos there. So to come back to the topic at hand. So thank you for that kind of picture. I think that really kind of paints a picture of the last like 20 years and the sort of shifting forces in the neighborhood. I'm kind of curious, could you tell me more about the community organizations that you spoke to, worked with for this article?
Yeah, so the community organizations, so they're working within this context of sort of internal displacement within the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, they're kind of filling the gaps here. But Le Table de Quartier, which is like a Maisonneuve, is one of the organizations, Le Centre Marie Debout, mm-hmm. and OPDS, the Organisation Populaire des Droits Sociaux. So Le Table is, it's a membership-based umbrella organization that's kind of made up of community organizations in the neighborhood. And they basically, their stated mission is to improve the lives of residents in the neighborhood. And they work across the board in different aspects like food security, mm-hmm. Health, and education.
They kind of help. I believe other neighborhoods have it. Their own version of Le Table, or their own kind of neighborhood groups that form their own tables. I believe they do offer this sort of like cohesion between these groups.
Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of what their role is to kind of liaise between these groups, which work in very disparate sectors.
Right. Just in the same neighborhood.
Yeah. And just to kind of get a sense of like what is what's the portrait of the neighborhood at the moment? What are the needs of the neighborhood? And you know, what are community groups kind of seeing or needing? Mm-hmm. And they do like research and surveys. So some of their work actually informed the article.
Incredible.
But I spoke with the interim executive director, Jonathan Allary. And then La Marie Debout is a women's center. It's just off of Pinneuf and Sainte-Catherine. And they provide like social support for women in the neighborhood, workshops on different social issues, the community activities, and they also engage in community activism. And they do serve women across socioeconomic levels, but they a portion of their community is lower income women. Mm-hmm. I spoke with the coordinator Fanny St. Pierre, and she also emphasized that there are a lot of older women and older women who are living in isolation who end up coming to the center. They have like computers set up so that women can access like the internet, if they need to like fill out forms or, do work.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah. And then Organisation Populaire des Droits Sociaux, OPDS.
Nice. We have a picture of their, their community space. It's a picture of their front. We see, just the front, the door. We see a little IWW logo. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so they're more of a militant group, and they work more independently. So mm-hmm. they are not members of La Table. Marie Debout is a member of La Table, but OPDS basically organizes to advocate for the rights of people who are living on social assistance mm-hmm. or who want to apply for social assistance, and they also organize the community activities and. They help people fill out applications and forms, and they also act as a little bit of a community center. So some people in the neighborhood have just been, have been coming to the center for many years. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and they're also kind of centrally located on Rue Ontario, which is that street on Main Street there. So they are like, yeah, they're located within, again, the heart, the heart of the neighborhood. And yeah, the photo just kind of shows one of the issues that I'll kind of talk about here. But yeah, they're not really an accessible space. This is kind of illustrative of some of the issues facing the neighborhood. A lot of buildings are not accessible for wheelchairs.
True.
Or people using walkers or canes. One of the characteristics of Hochelaga has been that there's a higher population of older people. Mm-hmm. The need for accessible accessible buildings. I mean, it's needed everywhere, but and this is a center that serves people who are living in poverty or in very vulnerable conditions. So when I was leaving the interview. There's a community member who also kind of coordinates with the center, and he uses a wheelchair, and he needed to be helped out of the building for an accessible bus to help him get to where he needs to go.
Right.
But there's all kinds of issues with
accessibility. The condition of the sidewalk. It's a little out of focus, but does not seem so fresh.
No, there are, it's one of the issues, this is again, a sort of an intersectional lens, there's so many layers, to physical accessibility to, social services and
centers.
But, potholes, streets that are kind of falling apart, stairs where you really don't need them.
Right. No, classic. Could you continue on this, topic of accessibility, because I think that, like you were saying, this is kind of like this huge intersectional, I think was a good word to describe this huge issue that kind of covers so many fronts, right? Because it's not only, you have this one angle of physical inaccessibility, right? Yeah. With the kind of conditions of the sidewalks, how buildings are not really fit for, to be accessible to those who have mobility issues. But then I think you also talk about the accessibility of these services as well, not even on the physical lens, right? But just the difficulty of accessing them. Could you speak more on that?
Yeah. So this is kind of where the article addresses this point that there's kind of these two pressures. So on one hand, the erosion of the public health and social services network, the inability of the public network to actually address people's needs. And then also the pressures of gentrification. So they're acting together to kind of compound the pressures on people who are living in very vulnerable conditions in the neighborhood. There's a lot.
Yep. Yeah. We have an unfortunately long list of
sort of
issues here.
Socially, unfortunately, long list.
But
I'll go through them. One issue that's particular to Hochelaga Maisonneuve was the retirement of a family doctor a few years ago who was located on Rue Ontario. And I was told that now, a couple years later, people are still without a family doctor. I think there was that statistic of just over 40% of...
42% of men.
42% of men. 23%, yeah. So it's quite significant, and people have been left without a doctor, somebody to follow their dossiers.
Of course.
So
these people used to have that kind of regular, incredibly sought after kind of privileged thing, right? To have this family doctor, and he retired, which obviously happens, but I think this is clear to show that as these doctors retire, there's not really any solutions. It's not like these.
Yeah.
It's not like his patients got transferred to someone else. They're sort of left, just left in the wind.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, with one of the issues that's commonly raised with the erosion of the public health sector, that was a big point in the
Common Front, right?
Protests over the past two seasons, is the inability for the public sector to retain doctors. Retain. Basically all staff, but people are just falling through the cracks. And in a neighborhood like Hochelaga Maisonneuve, where there are it's a lower income neighborhood, the social disparities are more prominent, that it has a significant impact, especially when, you know, people are, they're older, mm-hmm. and maybe they've had the same doctor who's been following their dossier for many years, mm-hmm. and now, you know, there's nobody to follow up, or, you know, if they do manage to find somebody, they're kind of starting from scratch.
Right.
A lot of that relationship with a doctor is also very personal. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a, you know, an impersonal, again, sterile experience, mm-hmm. medical services. Like, it's very intimate.
Of course, the doctor knows you. He knows the history of your health. So it doesn't feel like every time you're going in, it's like you're not just like a new number for whoever doctor. It's, you have someone who was familiar with, I guess, how your body works and how it doesn't work.
Yeah, and it's also, this was something that was talked about by Hind Fazazi from OPDS, but there's like a sense of, I'm adding this bit in, I'm saying this
bit. Yeah, let's hear it.
But there's a sense of trust, like you have to, you know, trust the medical service provider, of your course. Social worker, what have you.
It's a relationship like any other, right? So like over time you... become you're in a relationship with this kind of doctor and you get to know each other, you get to trust each other, but that's sort of not quite there if you're kind of going into clinics over and over, seeing new doctors.
Just to kind of get to the bit that Hind Fazazi had mentioned was the hostility and abuse within the public health network. Women, she was speaking specifically with the women's committee at OPDS, so she's kind of bringing some insight from that. But people are just, they're afraid to go to, you know, hospitals, they're afraid to go to the CLSC, they kind of expect to be treated poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a frightening situation to be in, especially if you're dealing with, an emergency or, you know, you don't know what's wrong, or maybe you know what's wrong, but, you know, you don't think that, you know, you're going to be treated well.
Of course, yeah.
So there's that. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask about, I think it's interesting because you have this kind of deteriorating or diminishing presence, right, of like kind of like the institution of public health in Oschleck-Maisonneuve. And I think what was interesting about the article to me was this one thing about, I guess, this measure of disadvantagedness, this kind of look, because like you, I guess in my head, what I'm trying to say is essentially like you have less public health, you have more private health, and obviously this private health is available to this kind of new growing population in Oschleck-Maisonneuve, which is this population of the higher income, the people who are buying these kinds of new condos, right? And I guess one thing I really thought was interesting was how this new population is sort of skewing statistics that some of these organizations and that the public health infrastructures use. Could you speak on that specifically?
That's an important point. It was brought up both by OPDS and La Table des Quartiers as well. La Table in particular, because they had done service, they created a portrait, Portrait de Quartier. And this is kind of a sense of statistical invisibility. There are two examples to kind of illustrate this. So one example is subsidized school lunch programs. There was an instance where these school lunch programs were cut in schools in Hochelaga, and you know, obviously this is very controversial. They were brought back. But what had happened was that the higher income of some of the families of students in a school, they were skewing the average income for the student body.
Yeah.
And it was deemed like, oh, okay, well, these programs aren't really necessary.
Right. So you have like the, because of this new kind of like population, you have sort of these income averages sort of going up into whatever section that the governing bodies are like, oh, so this, the average or the mean is sort of high now, so we don't need to offer this service.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's disproportionate because there's, the same students are there, in any other instance, like the, you know, people on lower income are still there, but it looks like they're not.
Right. Yeah.
It looks like, you know, maybe the neighborhood is
across the board, things are slowly going up, but it's really these kinds of outliers that are skewing these numbers.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so there's another example that Jonathan Allary from La Table had brought up, where you can have like a condo on the same block as like low-income, you know, say low-income seniors housing or like social housing. And once a condo is built, the representation of that postal code is going to be changed. Mm-hmm. It's going to look mm-hmm. like that postal code is actually richer, just because of this one building. And you know, you can kind of see how that can have a domino effect, even just on the perception, which kind of goes back to that the realtor website.
And right.
The shift, like. Yeah,
this image of a neighborhood that's being sold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of some of the other issues are the availability and affordability of public transit. The hospitals, I believe I mentioned this earlier, but yeah, the hospitals are located quite far.
Yeah.
So obviously, if you have an emergency, it can be difficult.
Can we have the next slide sort of speaks to this a little bit?
A little bit. It doesn't.
Yeah. So this doesn't
show the hospitals.
Only the CLSCs. Yeah.
So basically, they provide like vaccination, regular checkups, and psychosocial services.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of like. The thing is, on the map, they look a bit closer than they actually are.
Those are very large distances.
Yeah, I mean, considering like Montreal as a whole, proportionally, like, yeah, it can seem not far, but it is. There's also they're little things, but they're just part of daily life. Like, there's the hill that you have to kind of go mm-hmm. go up. It can be very difficult.
Especially for an aging population, like you're exactly. saying.
Yeah, and I think Alary had mentioned, some services aren't offered at the CLSC de Hochelaga Maisonneuve, so you have to go elsewhere.
To the further one.
You go to Rosemont. And actually, yeah, to get from down in the south, part of the neighborhood, where it's also, like, a higher level of, like, lower income residents mm-hmm. and social housing, you might not be able to afford to take a bus, so you have to walk, and there is a pretty steep, like relatively steep hill to get up and get to Rosemont.
Mm-hmm.
There's that.
Yeah, of course, this issue of physical inaccessibility or this kind of distance between these health centers.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing I thought was interesting in our conversations was this thing about you'll see this very often, right? Where you have kind of like governments, public bodies who try to like sell this idea of like we are innovating, we are modernizing our services. Mm-hmm. That usually means there's this sort of digitalization of some things where you have some of their services that are available either online, sometimes solely online or through your phone. And I think you make this interesting point about how that. As much as it sounds like, as much as for certain population, it makes it more accessible, for others, it makes it less accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was a point that was kind of raised across the board by the community organizations. And this is also like an area where they're sort of stepping in to help members of the community actually like get into the system, whether it's like, getting medical appointments or like social, accessing social services or filling out forms. It's just a point that's kind of overlooked often, this, technocratic solutionism, let's build an app for it. A lot of these apps are, they're compatible with like higher, more newer models of phones.
Mm-hmm.
There's also like issues with like user experience. Some of these apps, like they have small fonts. At Centre Marie Desboux, Fanny Saint-Pierre had mentioned that they often help, the centre often helps older women who come in try to set an appointment, for whatever service they need, and they're having troubles navigating the platforms. They can't, read the text, it's just like, user experience. It's this little mm-hmm. detail, but it's not really maybe considered through an intersectional lens very often. There's also like a frequently, platforms are frequently changing, or like you have to go to one platform and then suddenly there's a change, you have to use another platform to set your appointments. It's like Rendez-vous Santé Québec, Click Santé, Bonjour Santé.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go too much into it, but it is. I do want to mention that it does kind of introduce a little bit of an opening for corruption. I mean, there's always, you know, openings for corruption in everything, but there's the case with Tudelot, who created this app that kind of stratified. Well, they basically, they were working on Bonjour Santé, and they had stratified like access to services so you could pay for priority
access.
Access.
That's great. We love that in a public institution.
Yeah, it's app-based like technocratic solutions again. Are they really the way to go?
No.
Do they consider the people who are, you know, most vulnerable, who are, you know, living in poverty, who don't have access to laptops and phones, and, you know, who have to go somewhere physically to ask for help? Can you please, you know, help me fill out this form, if they can even get into the building?
I'm going to take a guess and say no.
No.
I do not believe those private companies who are tasked with creating these technocratic solutions care about that population.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's not reflected in the solution.
Definitely not.
Proposed solution. And which leads into the next point on literacy.
Yeah,
yeah, because this is quite a big point. In the neighborhood, the Fondation pour Alphabetisation, according to the 2021 report, just under 46% of respondents don't have a level of literacy that would be considered by the Fondation. To be like sufficient to be functional in society, in our technocratic society. So that is quite significant. It's quite reflective of the reality for the neighborhood, you know, on many different levels. But it just kind of situates like if you're being offered this, you know, this technical solution, you know, to use an app as like administrative workers are, you know, fading out of the public health and social services network, you're relying more and more on apps.
Of course.
You know, you can see how it can present more challenges if you're already navigating, you know, with like maybe there are issues with dyslexia, maybe you know, you just don't know how to read and write.
Right.
Like these are you know, realities for people.
And then these services are even more locked away from them, or kind of put further in, out of reach.
Yeah. And yeah, it's just a layer that's kind of taken for granted. Like, oh, we'll give you an app, we'll slap an app on it, and you will deal with it.
Yeah,
you know, you'll get a better job, and you know, you'll work harder, and you're gonna make more money, and you'll be able to afford that new phone to set your rendezvous with a private doctor.
In your brand new condo.
In your brand new condo.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Quite a grim.
Yeah, this is I guess sort of the I guess where the natural end, right, towards these kinds of trends is you have these more and more of the population of these kinds of neighborhoods that are going under immense kind of social economic change. You have these populations that are just slowly kind of like either left outside the system and barely even like reach, and like you have these populations that are left outside of the reach of these services that are already crumbling, and then you have these community groups that are trying their best to sort of bridge that, but clearly it's like, I mean, like it's incredibly noble and I think important work that they do to make sure that some of these populations are still reached out to and helped, but it is it's quite an uphill battle, I would say.
Yeah. And actually, OPDS, for example, you know, again, they kind of work independently, and they actually had like funding cut from like a major charity funder as well. So a lot of these community groups are kind of losing their ability to even, you know, like have people on staff or like do things.
I mean, it's like they're losing these like charity funding, this charity, the money, right, the funding that requires them to do the work that already the government should be doing, but it's clearly not really in their interest to do.
Again, I think
maybe not in their interest, I would say, because I do believe a lot of these health workers do want to do this work, but they just don't have the resources or the support to do it.
Yeah, and actually, you know, one of the quotes in the article for Pivot is Fanny Saint-Pierre saying that, you know, they're I'm just paraphrasing here, but that they are patching the gaps, but that they shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
That these services should be available in the public health and social services sector.
Yeah.
The fact that they have a nurse on staff is great, but, you know, for example, sex workers should feel comfortable going to the public,
of course,
you know, health system. Yeah, they shouldn't be afraid. Yeah. They shouldn't have to, you know, worry about, like, you know, police getting involved somehow through the public health system. You know, they shouldn't have to seek out alternatives.
Of course. It's almost like, maybe it's obvious to point out, but it's in the name, right? It's supposed to be public health. It's supposed to be things, mm-hmm. this institution that's available to anyone in the public to be able to use to get these services. And it's a shame that you have this section of the population, like sex workers, and among others, who are sort of nervous about using these services because of these prejudices that exist within it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We're sort of running low on time here, so I might ask us to skip ahead. Talking about, like, now going on, like, a much broader scale about these kinds of changes in the health and the public health kind of, like, industry, public health network. Mm-hmm. You kind of talk about Bill 15 a little bit.
Yeah. So it was mentioned, the community organizations talked about it a bit. At the moment, like, it's not quite clear, like, on the community level, how it's going to impact, but you can kind of, like, there are some parallels to concerns that have been raised on a regional level. So, for example, in the Uthaway, in Gatineau Hall, there were, like, within the past month or so, there were protests by the community health networks that really highlighted a concern with the creation of Santé Québec and the perceived, the perception that there might be a loss of autonomy and kind of specificity within regional health and social services networks to be able to address needs that are very specific mm-hmm. To those regions. So, the public health and social services network is already not able to address those needs,
mm-hmm.
but then, if they're losing a kind of a sense of autonomy or, like, specificity, that's, you know, particular to the regional.
Because of this increasing centralization, I believe it mm-hmm. is, through Bill 15.
Yeah, and, you know, it's been, like, presented as decentralization, but the argument is that, it's actually more centralization.
They love to do that.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's also shifting accountability away from, Christian Dubé, the position of the Minister of Health, toward the state-owned corporation, Santé Québec. That's also a concern. What this is pretty much saying is that you can anticipate a kind of domino effect, on a regional level into smaller communities, like Montreal, and then Hochelaga, Maisonneuve as a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Community organizations, they just the people I spoke with did kind of emphasize this concern, like, we're not really sure right now what it's going to look like, what the impacts are going to be, but we are concerned about, like, the loss of specificity and our mm-hmm. ability to address needs that are very specific to Hochelaga-Maisonneuve.
Of course.
CLSCs, again, the CLSC to Hochelaga-Maisonneuve kind of losing some services. And again, people turning to community organizations to fill those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like... that's already happening.
Right.
What's it going to look like later down the road? You know, how many more gaps are going to be opened once you lose some specificity in, like, regional and other forms of, like, public health administration?
Yeah. I think, to end on this question, I guess, do you feel like these currents in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve are unique to Hochelaga-Maisonneuve? Or do you think it's, what do you think is an important takeaway when we look at this, when you're giving us this portrait of this neighborhood?
Yeah, I think some of these are particular to Hochelaga-Maisonneuve.
Right.
So again, looking at, like, you know, some demographic aspects, like an older population,
mm-hmm.
Some of the geographic aspects, mobility, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is particular, but I think the trend is just pretty, like, it's across the board, across Montreal. You can look at other, like, lower income neighborhoods. Pointe-Saint-Charles, I think, went through, like, this whole wave of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak to the specificities of, like, you know, how community organizations were patching up gaps there, or, like, what, you know, what the specific needs for the public health and social services network was in Pointe-Saint-Charles.
Mm-hmm.
But the pattern of gentrification and the disenfranchisement of people from their own neighborhoods, their own, like, community homes is pretty universal. I think just generally, like, the concern and just the general like reflection of the erosion of the public health sectors. Yeah, it's very concerning. It's like you're treating public health and social services as a commodity, or like they're increasingly being treated as a commodity and a privilege rather than a basic human right.
Mm-hmm.
The way that this looks can be quite banal, but in a big picture, it's very disturbing, and it's this like long march of the erosion of Quebec's public health and social services network.
Lethal, thank you very much for coming onto the show, giving us this intimate, detailed portrait of the sort of gaps in health and social services in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, as well as what community groups are doing to combat them and bridge them.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. That's it for our main show, folks. Stay tuned. In 20 minutes, we will be starting Hello Goodbye Lines. Stay tuned. Hello. Goodbye Lines. The name of the show, the name of the program. Today, Savannah Recraig returns on this March 27 to discuss some of the coverage you've been doing, Savannah. How are you first?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad. I hear there are some people on a hunger strike at McGill.
There are some people on a hunger strike.
Tell me about it.
Yes. So it is now day 38, where student activists at McGill have been hosting a hunger strike. Essentially, they have been hosting a hunger strike in support of Gaza, and they say that they won't stop until McGill divests from companies that contribute to Israel and impose an academic boycott on Israeli institutions. Essentially, I met with a few of the activists a couple weeks ago, but things with the situation are developing quite fast. One of the initial hunger strikers, Rania, she ended her hunger strike a few days ago at day 34. She was actually hospitalized and required for health reasons to end the hunger strike. But there are currently two hunger strikers who continue. And there was one relay hunger striker. So essentially she was going on and off of the hunger strike. Right now she's not participating in the hunger strike and focused on organizing actions.
Gotcha. So I imagine the these demands. I imagine was it a few months ago we had the student population at McGill sort of vote on a referendum asking them for this, asking McGill, voting on getting McGill to sort of divest from money and connections they have attached to people in lobby groups that are sort of involved with Israel and the Israeli occupation. Do you see this as a sort of continuation of that effort?
Yeah. In a video that we'll check out in a few moments, one of the former hunger strikers, Bogdan, we were just chatting a little bit on camera about, you know, why are you doing this hunger strike? And essentially he had given me this long list of actions that McGill students were participating in, you know, such as the ones you've mentioned. We've seen people on the streets, especially McGill students on their own campus, but people outside of campus, protesting. And he was essentially saying, you know, we're doing sit-ins, we're protesting, we're boycotting, all of these things. And this was just another step in order to continue to apply pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. We could check out that clip to see what some of the hunger strikers had to say.
Let's.
We are not eating. We are taking a stance and saying, if you're going to put other people's health on the line, then we'll put ours in order to draw attention to this and to say that we don't agree and that we want it to change.
McGill students have been on a hunger strike for Palestine, with numerous activists striking for close to 30 days now. McGill has invested approximately $7 million in companies that manufacture arms and technology for the Israeli military.
We're asking McGill to divest from the genocide happening in Palestine and to commit to an academic boycott against Israeli institutions.
That money that we give to McGill is then being invested in these companies that then profit and contribute to the ongoing genocide. So that is McGill's role, and because McGill has chosen to take on that role, all the students have taken on that role.
Students say they've been in contact with McGill administration to organize a meeting in order to discuss their demands. However, organizers say that McGill has not been meeting their requirements, including only offering a closed-door meeting and only notifying them of a meeting only 48 hours in advance when activists requested McGill notify them a week in advance. In response to a request for comment, McGill said that they offered to meet directly with the students at the earliest possible date, but that this offer was declined.
There's currently no standing university left in Gaza, and we should be outraged about the fact that
saying, you know, we should be outraged about the fact that there are no universities left and that McGill is essentially involved in what's going on, you know, by funding companies or investing in companies that do essentially provide arms for Israel.
$7 million.
Yeah, at least $7 million. Okay. This was uncovered in an investigation by the McGill Daily. Essentially, they had gone through essentially McGill on their website. They have documents listed showing companies that they've invested in. So essentially through uncovering, you know, what's in these documents, they did find some companies, and I went through it myself. I found Lockheed Martin, which often is a name that comes up, you know, when we are talking about companies that are manufacturing arms for Israel. They have about, McGill has about over well over $500,000 invested in Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin provides the Israeli militaries with F-35 fighter jets, the Hellfire 9X missile, and the M270 multiple launch rocket system. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say pretty serious armaments, kind of serious weapons of war.
Yeah, that's probably, I think, one of the most notorious companies that they invest in, but one that's a little lesser known is Safran. They supply essentially biometric technology to conduct surveillance in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So students, they're applying pressure not only for, you know, divesting in companies that are, you know, manufacturing weapons used in Gaza, but also in the West Bank. So, you know, it's inclusive of all of Palestine. Another one is BAE Systems, which produces parts for F-35 fighter jets.
Okay,
as
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. So another investing money in companies that are either producing directly kind of aerospace technology, developing these jets, rockets, and or sort of biometric surveillance used to sort of keep a watchful eye over this population.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But for anyone who's interested in looking further, I mean, these documents are easily accessible on their website. So even, you know, beyond Israel, you know, you can see what else McGill is contributing towards.
Mm-hmm.
And I
how they use that student money.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I know, you know, the divest from fossil fuels movement has been big at Concordia. You know, Concordia is now divested in McGill too, and I think
this was a movement specifically
for universities to divest in companies like fossil fuels fossil fuel companies.
Right. So this was a movement they set about to divest, to get these universities to divest their funds, finances away from fossil fuel companies into, I mean, I guess not really into anything else, but just to get that money out of fossil fuels.
Essentially,
yeah. And I guess there's a similar movement here with these Palestinian support groups sort of trying to get the university to divest from these military contractor companies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, and there's been, you know, specifically towards the hunger strikers, they've been essentially gaining a lot of attention for what they're doing. You know, I first interviewed them a couple weeks ago, but since then, You know, I've kind of seen the issue blown up.
On a global scale, yeah.
Yeah, on a global scale and locally as well. You know, a lot of conversations are happening, you know, around what these hunger strikers are up to, around the evolutions of this movement. At the last two Palestine protests that are hosted every Sunday, weekly in Montreal, there were speeches. The most recent one on Sunday, an activist within the movement gave a speech, and then the Sunday before that I had attended, two of the, one activist from Palestinian Youth Movement and one activist from Montreal for Palestine shouted out these hunger strikers and essentially just tried to draw people's attention to what's going on and, you know, essentially advocating to support this movement.
Yes, incredible. So I think that global coverage, I mean, we were talking just now about this kind of global coverage these hunger strikers have been getting. There was an article in The Guardian, I believe, on this hunger strike. Mm-hmm. And I think something that was interesting that this video talks about too was people took issue with the... with McGill's sort of line in that article. I think I believe it was Chatty in your video just here was speaking about how there's this line that's sort of stated that it's McGill's trying to angle this as if the hunger strikers aren't willing to meet, right? As if the hunger strikers are kind of resistant to meeting, and it kind of paints them out to be uncooperative. But then it seems like that's not quite the case when you spoke to hunger strikers.
Yeah, yeah, we can, if you just want to switch the slides. So this is the article that Calden's talking about in The Guardian. Canadian students hunger strike for college to divest from Israel-linked firms. Several McGill University students have spent more than 3 weeks demanding schools divest $200 million from... $20 million from various companies. Thank you.
No problem.
So this is the article, and we can just check out the next slide for what McGill had said. So McGill on Friday issued a statement saying it's concerned about the well-being of students participating in this initiative. You know, McGill essentially said that they respect the rights to free speech, free assembly within the limits of university policy and law. And they said that, you know, they've repeatedly offered to meet with the student protesters directly, though they have so far declined. This offer still stands. We have clearly communicated the procedures available for expressing concerns about the university's investment holdings or for advocating policy changes. These students have chosen a different approach. Our hope is that they will understand that universities' policies will not be determined this way, in this way before their well-being is affected. We urge them to make choices that prioritize their health. So this is McGill's statement in the Guardian article that we just looked at. And these hunger strikers, they have this Instagram account at McGill Hunger Strike. Where essentially they provide daily updates and just essentially use this Instagram account as a tool to, you know, keep people informed and also to continue to apply pressure on mm-hmm. McGill to divest. And they had essentially screenshotted and shared this article and, you know, said that they had conflicting views. You know, they essentially addressed McGill's comment unfollowing university procedures for divestments, and they responded saying that, you know, McGill evades these regulations seen in the divestment from the fossil fuels movement. Essentially, they were saying that, you know, activists in the divestment movement for fossil fuels have been applying pressure for about a decade, and it took this long for McGill to apply that pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not something that they mentioned in this Instagram post, but I know that with speaking with activists, they have essentially, you know, said to me numerous times and to the public numerous times, like, we don't have this long, like, we need to do this now. And I think that this is why they're, you know, choosing such an intense form of resistance and putting their health on the line,
right,
to just essentially show, you know, it is our lives on the line and it's thousands of Gazans on the line mm-hmm. as well. Thousands of Gazans' lives on the line as well. In this post, they also said that, you know, McGill is ignoring pleas from students to divest from companies arming Israel. I quote, McGill's statements to the media are disingenuous and aim to portray us as stubborn and uncooperative. We have not denied meeting them. And then, you know, essentially as we saw in the video we watched earlier, you know, their demands in order to have a meeting with McGill is that they have a public meeting and a one-week notice. Essentially what McGill has repeatedly offered to these hunger strikers is a private meeting, closed-door meeting, with a maximum of 8 students. And the hunger strikers, they're not necessarily denying a meeting. They want the meeting to happen, but they're denying having a meeting under these conditions. Mm-hmm. So essentially in their call out of what McGill said in this article is that they're saying McGill is you know, disingenuous in how they're representing these hunger strikers, because the hunger strikers have not denied a meeting. They've just denied these conditions
for right, a meeting. Right. It seems like the main impediment to a meeting taking place is not really the hunger strikers, but just this kind of difference in the conditions or the sort of the agreed upon conditions for a meeting. It seems to be quite different. And I guess that's not really reflected in the article, the Guardian article, especially by McGill's line. McGill gave makes it sound like the hunger strikers are sort of like resistant to any kind of dialogue, right? Which sort of does portray them as stubborn and uncooperative, especially in the way that McGill sets itself out to be. It makes them sound like they're very concerned about the health. And there's this kind of, paternalist tone to that. You know, it's like, we care more about your health. We tried reaching out, but they haven't yet. But, you know, we urge you to kind of consider your health first. It seems like that's not quite the issue at hand, you know. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's it's an ungenerous depiction of the discrepancies mm-hmm. that come from this meeting. I wonder if there's going to be any kind of negotiations or sort of... Because I guess two days closed doors is not too... That would definitely put this group at a disadvantage to mm-hmm. or apply more pressure. But it's interesting to see how this is going to develop.
Yeah. And, you know, even outside of The Guardian, there's been coverage by other outlets, such as Democracy Now! reported on this situation about a couple weeks ago. But there's also been reports in the Middle East Eye, The New Arab, and a few other outlets I came across as well, non-Canadian, non-American outlets. Mm-hmm. So it really is on this international level. And
of course.
Especially, you know, since this one protester was hospitalized, I think that gained a lot of attention. And I did notice, I thought it was interesting in the Guardian article, I think McGill was a bit more firm with them. Whereas, you know, when I reached out, McGill had this, you know, I reached out to McGill for a comment before publishing my video. And essentially they said, I quote, "We respect students' rights to pursue political objectives and express political convictions. Our priority remains the health and well-being of the students participating in the hunger strike. We offered to meet directly with these students at the earliest possible date, but that offer was refused. We understand that this is an incredibly difficult time. We continue to work daily on this issue and to ensure that the health and safety of students remain at the forefront of our efforts." I think that it's, you know, it is. There is a lot of similarities.
Between,
you know, the statement they gave me and the statement they gave to The Guardian.
Sure.
But I sense in The Guardian article they seem more firm.
Yeah.
And maybe that also comes from, you know, this isn't just a local outlet covering this now.
Mm-hmm.
This is The Guardian.
Of course, yeah. This British publication, international attention, so they want to seem perhaps a little more firm, like you're saying, to a wider audience. I think there's something really interesting about their note about policy and law, because, like, if we look at that quote, McGill respects the right to free speech and free assembly within the limits of university policy and the law, which I think is kind of interesting given that they sort of went against that student referendum that happened, right? Because, like, if we think about that referendum that happened back in, what was it, like November, I think, where you had a huge record turnout for the kind of referendum that they had, that was completely within student policy. That was completely within the confines of McGill policy, of law, and they still went against it, right? They still kind of, like,
decided to like ignore. They called upon like there's this kind of call upon the Quebec Superior Court even to call an injunction on to stop it, right? So it's like, I don't know. They want it to be about the law until it doesn't serve their interests, and then it's not really about the law. I find that's at least I think it's interesting to bring up law and policy when they've sort of acted even against that.
I know that with that case, I can't for the life of me recall exactly what the vote was. I think it was essentially to like uphold BDS or essentially like.
Yeah. They called upon McGill to divest. Specifically, the language of the of that referendum was really notable because it has the student body that voted upon it. I think in upwards of 70%, it was like a super majority of the voters that voted in favor of it. They were specifically called out Israel as a genocidal, colonial and occupying force, and they're calling upon McGill to divest from any funds it has that has involved with that occupation, as well as connections and relationships that they have with groups that are involved with those kinds of, with that kind of like settlement, right? Mm-hmm. I think what was great about that referendum was I think the specificity of language and the kind of not the harshness is not quite the word, but it was really like kind of like pointed kind of a definition of Israel as a genocidal apartheid. Apartheid was one important word that I think was involved in that language, and you had the university sort of mobilized to block it, as well as other bodies. I know apparently B'nai B'rith was involved as well.
Yeah,
with the legal counsel.
I'm not sure about McGill blocking it, but I know that it was a student at McGill was offended and essentially. Was in contact in some way with B'nai B'rith, who's representing them in that lawsuit.
Sure.
I can't recall McGill's actual response, but I do know that with students at McGill I've interviewed over the last few months, they've said that there's like a clear, McGill is clearly unsupportive of pro-Palestinian activism.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's this kind of natural institutional bias that comes with these investments, right? That mm-hmm. comes with the work that's going to take to divest them away from these funds, which they believe to be profitable and better for, I don't know if it's better for the university, but I believe it to be better on a pure, like, profit line.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. But McGill, like, McGill students, they are quite active. You know, I mean, we've seen a lot of mobilization in Montreal over the last few months, but even just before coming on air now, I read online that students at McGill are currently blocking the entrances of three classes.
Right now.
Unless it ended in the last, however...
20 minutes.
20 minutes we've been talking. You know, these are the faculties of engineering, management, and education, and these activists are saying that these departments are complicit in the occupation of Palestine and Israel's bombardment of Gaza. Just to be clear, from what I saw, it didn't seem that the hunger strikers were involved, that these were other organizations, pro-Palestinian organizations. Sure. But it just kind of goes to show that from many different fronts, there are activists there, you know, continuing to apply pressure, you know, whether sit-ins, blockades, mobilizations or hunger strikes.
The effort continues. The effort continues.
Yeah, it does.
Thank you for bringing this on to Hello Goodbye Line, Savannah. Mm. This is our last episode.
Yeah, it
is. Our last episode. For those listening, thank you for being a part of the journey. I want to thank everyone here at CUTV, Drew, Sophia, Ode, Neha, yourself, Savannah, Fraser, Marie Fleur, I'm forgetting people, Clement, you know, I think there's a lot of people who've been a part of this program, supporting it in different ways, and unfortunately, we gotta call it to an end, because sort of the funding was cut, but people can keep an eye on developments in Montreal. You're going to be staying on with Local 514. And thank you, Savannah, for coming on to the show so many times and bringing your reporting to our audience.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for hosting this show. It's been great to watch.
Yeah. My pleasure, absolutely. This is the last one, folks. Take care of yourselves. Stay informed.